Bill, it is 11:35 p.m. Eastern. We just finished watching the Browns beat the Giants. I don't care about any of that. Do you care about any of that?
No, not at all.
Bill Barnwell is the host of the Bill Barnwell Show podcast, and he writes a high-powered NFL column each week on ESPN+. I feel like we need to start this show by just giving a moment of silence to the Jets.
We all can't get what we want for Christmas, Pablo.
I mean, I still can't believe this finally happened. And it happened against the supposed best team in the NFC West.
The final score, the Jets get their first win of the season in what has to be the biggest upset this year in the National Football League. The Jets 23 and the Rams 20.
Adam Gase has wronged the Jets in so many ways. But his final act, his last vindictive attack on the New York Jets organization and their fan base, was to cost them Trevor Lawrence. Beating a playoff team on the road to win their first game of the season was hugely damaging to the future of the franchise and met with almost universal scorn from the fan base. Even if you had to script a victory for the Jets, this would be the worst way for it to happen. The focal point of the offense in this game was Frank Gore, who carried the ball 23 times, scored a 4th-and-1 touchdown, and converted the final 2 third downs to seal up this heartbreaking victory. It's not as if the Jets even stumbled on some new offensive weapon to build around after this season ends. Gore is going to the Hall of Fame. Adam Gase might end up being the one who inducts him in Canton.
Yes, the Jets won. A singular event on the NFL's 15th Sunday. And there was a trend on display too. High-scoring games, the hallmark of a larger offensive revolution. Our own Bill Barnwell explains why. I'm Pablo Torre. It's Monday, December 21st. This is ESPN Daily. So, Bill, should Jets fans just come to terms with the reality that Trevor Lawrence is going to be a Jaguar at this point? Should they be making peace with the fact that the Jets, for the first time, it feels like somehow weren't bad enough and are therefore in their own way somehow even worse?
Well, they need to start rooting for Gardner Minshew because the Jets need help to end up with the right to draft Trevor Lawrence with the first overall pick. They are now tied with the Jaguars at 1-13, but Jacksonville has played an easier schedule, and losing against an easier schedule is the first tiebreaker. They are now pushed in to the top spot, or I guess the worst spot. Of course, the first overall pick in the 2021 NFL draft when Trevor Lawrence presumptively will leave Clemson and join the Jacksonville Jaguars. To get Lawrence, they need to have the Jaguars beat either the Bears or the Colts, two pretty solid football teams, in one of their final two games to get back in line to draft Lawrence. If they don't, the Jaguars will get one of the most heralded prospects out of college in recent memory with the first overall pick. And the Jets, who have been basically getting ready to sell Trevor Lawrence jerseys for most of the past 2 months, will have to be in line for a lesser quarterback prospect like Justin Fields or Trey Lance.
With just 2 games left now in the regular season, I do want to zoom out because we've been taking this microscope to the league week after week after week this year. And I'm just curious at this point, what have you noticed that's different about how the game has been played overall in 2020?
Yeah, there's a really interesting big picture thing happening, which is that teams are scoring a lot. It's important to understand just how different this season is and how football is in 2020 generally relative to what we saw 20 or 30 years ago, or even really 10 years ago. Teams are averaging 24.8 points per game this season. It's the most in history by a considerable margin. It's up 1.4 points per game from the previous record and 2 full points per team per game from what we saw even in 2019. And the Chiefs and Saints, I would say, are a perfect example of how explosive good offenses can be, even on days where they really aren't at their best. I mean, look at that game on Sunday. Patrick Mahomes was 1 of 8 for 16 yards on deep passes. Drew Brees completed less than 50% of his pass attempts. The Saints failed to recover a fumble in the end zone that would have given them a touchdown, and so they got a safety. Those two teams still got to 61 points. That would have been a staggering number even 10 years ago, or especially 20 years ago. And that's pretty common these days. When you're playing an offense like the Chiefs or the Saints, you can't coach like you're playing a team from 1980 or 1990. Possessing the football and scoring as many points as possible are the only things that matter in the modern game. And as we get to the postseason here, so many of the teams who are locked in are there because they have great offenses. We're coming off of a season where the Chiefs won the Super Bowl, and the only two defense-first organizations that are lining up to play in the postseason who are locks to get in are the Steelers and maybe the Colts. The game's changed.
So the dominance, Bill, of the offense-first approach, I mean, that does seem undeniable. You make a great case for it. I want to dive further into that, but I also want to ask you about Drew Brees for a second, because he played in this game after having 11 broken ribs, a collapsed lung, and perhaps logically, he kind of looked washed often against the Chiefs, but I know it also wasn't that simple. So what exactly did the Saints get from Brees in this game, and how concerned should they be as they try to keep pace with a team like the Chiefs?
I would like to assure you, Papo, that you can also look washed without having 11 broken ribs. It was weird. It was a very weird game from the Saints and a weird game from Drew Brees because, number one, he started 0 for 5 for the first time in his career, 5 consecutive incompletions to start the game. This is Drew Brees we're talking about, the most accurate quarterback in the history of the National Football League, barely completing more than 33% of his passes before that late game surge. Now, he didn't look like his usual self. He didn't always give his receivers the sort of perfect passes on time that he's known for. But they also let him down. There were a bunch of drops on the shorter passes in this game. And strangely, for a guy who, like you said, was recovering from 11 broken ribs and even at his best is not known for his deep passing, Brees was better on those deep throws than he was in the shorter attempts. He got better as the game went along. Now, Brees will tell you he has to improve. He's not going to go very far, completing less than 50% of his passes. But I don't think Taysom Hill is going to disappear from this offense. He only played 7 snaps on Sunday, but he'll touch the ball on 4 of them, including a pair of goal line touches and a touchdown. The Saints put Michael Thomas on injured reserve before this game. It's pretty clear they're preparing more for the postseason than for the rest of the regular season. They only have a slim chance of finishing with the top seed in the NFC after losing 2 straight. So it wouldn't shock me if we saw plenty of Brees over the next couple of weeks, but we also saw more Taysom Hill figured in over the rest of the season.
So we know the Saints are going to have to find ways, Taysom Hill or not, to compete in this postseason arms race with offenses surging, as you mentioned, Bill. But looking around the league, this trend isn't just happening among playoff contenders, right? I mean, on Sunday, we just saw the Ravens blowing out the Jaguars 40-14. We saw the Cowboys dropping 41 on the Niners. It seems to be everywhere at this point. So what's behind a meaningful uptick in points like this? Is there a specific reason that you found in 2020?
Yeah, I think it's a few things. I mean, we talked about the decrease in holding penalties at the beginning of the season, but it's more than that. I mean, teams are moving the ball down the field better than they ever have because they've stopped pretending that running the football is what actually wins football games. It seems pretty logical. Look at the yards you gain on a pass play and the yards you gain on a running play to conclude that passing the ball is more important. Of course, there was always that famous trope about how only 3 things can happen when you pass and 2 of them are bad. But that means less than ever before. Interceptions are at the lowest rate in league history. Sacks, I believe, are the 4th lowest rate now in NFL history. When you pass in 2020, a good thing happens almost all of the time. And on top of that, it's just harder to get the ball back. Organizations have realized after 20 years of kids playing Madden and fans booing in the stands when he punt on fourth and short, that the only people who don't want to go for it in those situations are coaches. With the math and popular opinion in their favor, they've been more emboldened to try and convert fourth down than ever before. Kickers are also hitting field goals at the seventh highest rate in league history. So you need to stop teams earlier to keep them off of the scoreboard. So in 2020, the best and really maybe the only way to stop the opposing offense is to not let them on the field.
So I want to turn now to another high scoring game that we saw on Sunday, Bill. And that was the one involving Kyler Murray throwing for a career high 406 yards and the Cardinals coming back to beat the Eagles 33-26. But the focus that I'd like you to take here is on Philly's quarterback, Jalen Hurts, because this was just his second NFL start. He had three touchdowns passing, a fourth touchdown rushing.
Snap comes back to Hurts. He's looking. He starts to run. He cuts back. He dives forward. He lunges. He is in for the touchdown. Hurts with his first rushing touchdown.
And it's also, thanks to Adam Schefter, a game that occurred against the backdrop of Eagles quarterback, the previous incumbent starter, Carson Wentz, apparently making known that he doesn't want to be Jalen Hurts' backup in Philly. Shocking. So where does all this leave the Eagles at quarterback?
Well, in the short term, Pablo, Carson Wentz isn't going to have a choice unless Jalen Hurts gets injured, because Jalen Hurts is massively outplaying Carson Wentz. I know the Eagles came up short on Sunday, but the rookie was more impressive as a passer in his second career start than he was in that victory over the Saints. Hurts took six sacks. He did fumble three times. The Eagles, of course, recovered all three of those fumbles. He wasn't as safe with the football as he had been the prior week, but Hurts repeatedly bailed the Eagles out in third and long situations to extend drives and score points. The Eagles are still in the NFC East hunt, with the Giants and Washington both losing on Sunday. Their offense has been much better with Hurts at quarterback. When it comes to Wentz's future after the season, though, the Eagles don't have many options. They're already $64 million over the projected $175 million cap in 2021. That's a lot of money. And even worse, they can't save any money if they cut or trade Wentz before the 2021 season begins. If Wentz wants to leave, the only way it can really work that the Eagles trade Wentz at the absolute bottom of his value as the backup quarterback before March and save no money in 2021 in the process. Even if Wentz doesn't want to be stuck in Philadelphia behind Hurts, he doesn't have a choice until some cap space is finally freed up in 2022.
All right, Bill, coming up, it is time for us to pay tribute at long, long last to the Buffalo Bills.
Vivid Seats wants to get you to the games you love this spring. Experience every pitch, assist, and game-winning shot live and in person. And the best part? Each transaction is a step toward a free 11th ticket with Vivid Seats rewards. Score unbeatable perks like free tickets, surprise seat upgrades, and annual birthday deals. As the official ticketing partner of ESPN, Vivid Seats is offering you $20 off your first $200 ticket purchase with code DAILY. That's code DAILY. Visit VividSeats.com or download the app today. Vivid Seats. Experience it live.
So, Bill, I want to rewind to Saturday, because that's when the Buffalo Bills won their first AFC East title since 1995, which happens to be the year before their quarterback, Josh Allen, was even born. And the Bills steamrolled the Broncos 48-19. Their fans in Buffalo gave them this hero's welcome at 2 a.m. on an irresponsibly freezing tarmac. And anyone who is still waiting, I guess, for Josh Allen, the hero in question, to regress, they're just going to keep waiting. So what did you see from Josh Allen against Denver, Bill?
I mean, I saw a quarterback who is in total control of his surroundings. And I guess it's maybe a little poetic that Josh Allen's best game as a professional quarterback by QBR was in fact his game against the Broncos on Saturday. He posted a QBR of 98.2. And I think back to the last thing we saw from Allen a year ago in the 2019 season, his performance against the Texans in the wild card game, which was a hodgepodge of just brilliance and bizarre out of control plays. It felt like a six-year-old playing Madden. They might stumble into something great and they might lateral for no reason with no warning. That's just how it works.
It felt spastic.
It felt spastic, Pablo. That's a great, great word. We knew Josh Allen had upside, but the question was always going to be whether he had the composure and the experience and the comfort level to access that upside. And on Saturday, we saw a quarterback who was in absolute total control from start to finish. When the Broncos pressured Allen, he made smart plays with the football.
Broncos rush five. Josh gets away from pressure, going to keep it and run with it. Inside the 15, inside the 10, headed for the end zone, touchdown. Josh Allen, a 24-yard touchdown run for the Buffalo Bills.
And when they didn't pressure Allen, he took the Broncos apart. He was 22 of 25 for 293 yards with two passing touchdowns. Allen was absolutely incredible.
On the snap, Allen looks, guns it downfield, strike, touchdown, Jake Kumerow, touchdown, Buffalo. He threw a strike, an absolute fastball to Jake Kumerow for his first.
And I think to get to your question, really, the way I think about it is this: it would be more of a surprise to me if Allen had a bad game and took a step backwards to be that guy we were in 2019 than it would be for Allen to keep playing at this level as one of the best quarterbacks in football. It would be shocking if he was the guy we saw in the 2019 wildcard game. He's a totally different quarterback at this point of his career. He's, I would probably say, third in the MVP race behind Patrick Mahomes and Aaron Rodgers. Right now, the Bills look like the toughest competition in the AFC for the Kansas City Chiefs. And we know for the first time in 25 years, they're going to have a home playoff game.
Yeah, it's all so crazy. And you said the word control a couple times there. So I want to understand how Josh's limbs are more under control, how this offense is more under control. And that brings us to Brian Daboll, who is their offensive coordinator. And I mostly remember that guy as something of a like mediocrity, honestly, just kind of bouncing around Bill Belichick's expanded universe. But this season, Bill, he's built this really creative, really entertaining offense. Did you see this coming?
No. No, let me be very clear about that. Absolutely not. I'm very surprised that Josh Allen has been this good. I might be even more surprised that Brian Daboll has been this good. I mean, he, like you said, was a positional coach with the Patriots and the Jets. He got a few shots as the offensive coordinator for three different NFL teams, the Browns, the Dolphins, and the Chiefs. His offenses there were anonymous. They were bad. They were 20th or worse in points scored in each of his four seasons as an offensive coordinator, including a last place performance in his final year with the Chiefs. I wasn't optimistic when the Bills hired him to take over as the offensive coordinator. And this offense has been a revelation this year. Bills run a modern attack with heavy doses of play action and motion, which the evidence suggests are easy ways to create improved efficiency for your offense. Buffalo's offense has been really aggressive at shifting their ideas from week to week. There are games where they're very run heavy. Then there are games like the one against the Seahawks, where they were one of the most pass happy attacks in a single game in league history. Really, this offense can be so many different things from week to week. But more than anything, this offense is fun. The Bills have one of the widest ranges of trick plays of anybody in football. And we saw last year in the wild card game, with the early touchdown pass Josh Allen caught, Daboll's willing to call anything in any situation. Take Saturday night, of course. The Bills were near the goal line and they ran mesh, which is a core air raid concept. Teams typically run with a pair of 180-pound slot receivers running across the middle of the field. Bills ran it with 265-pound blocking tight end Lee Smith and 300-pound reserve offensive lineman Ryan Bates. It was the biggest mesh in the history of football. Bates was unfairly flagged for offensive pass interference, which, by the way, if you are 300 pounds or more, that is outlawed. You should not be ever penalized for offensive pass interference. You are only helping with the pass. You are never interfering. But this is just a fun offense to play in as a quarterback. It's fun to watch as a observer, and it works. It's made everyone better. Daboll's produced a really unlikely second act in Buffalo, and it's probably going to net him a head coaching opportunity this offseason.
Well, speaking of large people doing absurd things, Bill, let's turn to Derrick Henry and the 10-4 Tennessee Titans, who blew out the Lions 46-25. And look, all year we've marveled at Henry, who's now run for more yards than he did last season. So all of it I get, but Titans quarterback Ryan Tannehill, I was just looking at his numbers. I mean, he's been remarkable. He's now thrown for 30 touchdowns, just 5 picks on the season. So who do you think matters more to the team at this point, Henry or Tannehill?
I think it changes from week to week. Last week, Henry ran for 215 yards and 2 touchdowns as he tormented the poor Jaguars, a team that he absolutely just destroys from year to year. This week, Henry had a good game, ran for 147 yards and a score, but Tannehill had a nearly flawless day. The former Dolphins starter was responsible, 5 touchdowns, 3 of which came through the air, and 2 more on the ground, including a really impressive 19-yard scramble for a score.
Play fake, Tannehill rolling to the left. He can run this thing. 15, 10, 5, dive for the end zone. Tell me something, sir. They're talking. Touchdown, Titans!
And Henry is rightfully getting attention as an offensive player of the year candidate. He deserves it. He's having a fantastic season. But teams just can't afford to stack the box against Henry and take away the run, because Tannehill puts up these sort of monster games when they do. When teams put him in a position to throw the football, he hits chunk play after chunk play and has been doing it now for a year and a half. Honestly, given how much Tannehill gets when he throws the football, you might rather let Henry run.
And another team that is 10-4 happens to be the Seattle Seahawks, Bill. And look, they beat the Washington football team on Sunday 20-15, but Russell Wilson still isn't cooking in the way that he was alleged to be. So how are the Seahawks looking to you at this point? Are they a team that you can see beating the other division leaders in the NFC like the Packers or the Saints?
I think they have a high ceiling, but I'm not sure, because we've gone from confirmed cooker to alleged cooker with the Seahawks offense. And I think we have to see more of the Russ, who was an MVP candidate in the first half of the year, because he hasn't been that guy in the second half. And over the first half of the year, he had 13 completions, traveling 30 or more yards in the air, 3 more than anybody else in football. Since then, over the second half of the year, he's 1 for 10 on those throws. He didn't even attempt one of those throws in this game. And without those big plays, Pablo, the Seahawks need to be really ruthlessly efficient on offense, and they haven't been doing that. If you could somehow combine the Seahawks offense from the first half and their defense from the second half, you would have a truly great football team. You would have a team that could absolutely compete with the Packers and the Saints. But the Seahawks really haven't had a game where they've been great on both sides of the ball against a playoff contender even once this season. They're going to have to do it 3 or 4 times come January.
So I'm looking around at the standings at the row of teams just below the Packers, the Saints, the Seahawks, and we find Tom Brady's Buccaneers sitting right there, 9-5, second in the NFC South, and their defense has been quite good, it seems. But on Sunday, Bill, they go down 14-0 to the Atlanta Falcons. And look, obviously, you know the Falcons ultimately naturally falconed. They lose 31-27. So how seriously should we be taking Tampa Bay?
Poor Falcons. Just
every time, man. Every time.
Even compared to the Chargers. It's another story for another podcast. But with the Buccaneers, they looked hopeless in the first half against the Falcons. Their offensive line was struggling to keep one of the league's most ineffective pass rushes off of Tom Brady. They didn't seem to have any answers to make Brady's life easier. And the Falcons were scoring an offense. They were moving the ball effectively. They seem to be on the road for an easy victory until you remembered that they are the Falcons. And at halftime, the Bucs somehow figured out how to protect Brady and flip the game. He was pressured on just 3.3% of his dropbacks in the second half. We've talked about this every week.
Yes.
When Brady doesn't get pressured, he is the old Tom Brady. And he threw for 329 yards and 2 touchdowns in the second half. And the Bucs became the latest team to break the hearts of Falcons fans. We'll be right back. My problem with this, though, Pablo, the Bucks are not going to get to play the Falcons come January. And I just don't get any sense that they have any sort of handle on what makes them great for extended periods of time. We know that they have the ceiling of a top-tier team, but I just don't trust that offense to work for three or four games at a time.
Bill Barnwell, I just want to say this. Thank you for being great for extended periods of time on ESPN Daily.
I am allegedly a great guest. Thank you, Papa.
Okay, up next, the Muppets take Monday Night Football.
Now let's talk about the play of the week. The pressure to follow up Hypnotic and Cognac weighing heavy on the team. Hypnotic was in the cup, blue, and ready for the play. And boom, Añejo Tequila came in with a smooth assist to Hypnotic's tropical fruit finish. Shaken, strained, poured, it was green and good. The playmaking splash shifted the tempo. Another great cocktail from the Hypnotic team. Every season is Hypnotic and tequila season. Hypnotic Liqueur, Bardstown, Kentucky. 17% alcohol by volume. Hypnotic reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely.
Here's another story I want you to know. Monday Night Football is getting some special holiday guests as the Steelers face off against the Bengals. ESPN's Rico Labbé is the director producer behind it, and he gave us an inside look. So, Rico, what are we calling this collaboration on Monday Night Football?
It's called Muppets Night Football. Basically, kind of a takeover of Monday Night Football.
Football! Ah, Bengals! Ah, Steelers! Muppets.
You'll see Miss Piggy and Kermit in the booth, Fozzie as a sideline reporter, Waldorf and Statler as the guys in the stands, you know, in the nosebleeds.
What a great night of football!
Yeah, too bad they're going to ruin it with the Muppets.
And then we have Animal as our halftime highlight.
Monday night! Monday night!
And Animal knows, like, what Spider 2Y Banana is. Animal is very well versed in breaking down all of the X's and the O's.
Yes, yes. Animal has a unique way of bringing out all the different dynamics of football that most people don't know. You know, he's in with all the GMs and everything like that.
So, Rico, you're a former player yourself. You played in the league.
Yes.
Who is most equipped to maybe play in the NFL themselves among those Muppets?
Oh, wow. That's a great question. You definitely have to start with Animal because, you know, he has that kind of personality. It's the wild man kind of personality.
He has a motor, I think, is how you would call it, right?
Yeah, exactly. He has the motor. I think you would want the focus of it coming from Kermit. Kermit has great focus. Great focus. And, yeah, I'm going to throw in Fozzie, too.
Because
Fozzie has a personality. He's very inquisitive.
I like to think that Fozzie, as a bear, can go beast mode at a certain point.
Yeah, exactly. Marshawn Lynch on it.
So I want to understand the behind-the-scenes particulars of how this all came together. How'd you guys pull all of this stuff off, like, mechanically?
You know, because of the pandemic, you know, obviously we can't fly around. We can't shoot in certain locations. So they did it at their homes. All the Muppets are at, like, six different Muppeteers' homes. And these Muppeteers, they do multiple voices. Voice to voice to voice to voice. It was amazing.
Hark, how the balls soar through the night. Steelers and Bengals footballs in flight. Oh, and they're now raising the sound. Tackle and smash into the ground. All season long, mighty and strong. Everybody cheer, football is here.
They're shooting on green screen. It was a Zoom shoot. We had our open Zoom. And everybody came in with their kids to watch the actual Zoom meeting with the Muppets. And they were so engaged with the kids in the, you know, after the shoot and in between shoots.
You got a private audience with the Muppets. That's your kids better. They owe you something good.
Man.
We knew we wanted to do something that was, you know, had joy in it, put a smile on people's faces. So let me shout out to the Monday Night Football crew, also Craig Lazarus and Julie McGlone and Brian Rourke, Amanda Pascal, and Justin Belcher. Those people worked tirelessly on this thing. Mm-hmm. We just wanted to make sure that we left this year with something, you know, fun.
Rico, has any one of the Muppets sort of like been elbowing you a little bit for like a gig on Monday Night Football? Because we know that this is the booth of all booths. Is anyone trying to like get in on that?
You know, the only one that I think would, because they have the attitude, is Miss Piggy.
Yeah.
I have to give it to her. She's the one that could rock and roll on air. There's no doubt about it. There's no doubt about it. You know how they have the Super Bowl Media Day?
Mm.
Yeah, she may want to show up for that.
Rico, thank you so much for giving us a bit of insight into how Muppet Night Football came together.
We got to go have a drink, man, with one of the Muppets.
Dude, you have no idea how long I've been waiting for someone to say that very sentence.
Thank you, Pablo.
I'm Pablo Torre. This has been ESPN Daily. I'll talk to you tomorrow.